It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplexes and at the art house.
Warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area.
You'll also hear about new and old films on Blu-ray and on DVD. Plus, you'll hear all the latest Hollywood gossip.
I don't care!
Okay, maybe not the latter, but it is time for Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Shizzy!
No, that's Matthew Sosi.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever, yes.
Let's see how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sosi.
Film lovers, welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Sosi. The show is available as a podcast, and it's also available on iTunes. And I have a guest in studio. For the record, I think I asked 9:30 Wednesday morning, and he has his own intro. You know him. You love him. Here it is.
Lawrence of Arabia. He's an English guy. He came to fight the Turkish.
Okay, Clark, right there. That's what I'm talking about. Lawrence of Arabia doesn't have any lyrics to it. Doesn't have any words.
What do you mean doesn't have lyrics?
It's music.
To it?
It's music.
Hey, I've seen the movie four times.
And there were no words to it.
What are you
there are no words to that. Did you hear what I was singing earlier?
Somewhere I know that somebody, I think, wrote lyrics to this song.
It wasn't me. I didn't do it.
Mike Perry's in studio, ladies and gentlemen.
Hey, Matthew.
How are you?
I'm doing all right. And you?
Getting there. We'll get there. And of course, we just heard, of course, our favorite non-female member of Hee Haw.
Gaylord Sartain.
And actually, I thought of you because I saw Gaylord in a film on Christmas Day on vacation. So I was down in Florida with my family and my in-laws, and everything was just kind of lackadaisical, and you just kind of channel surf and see what's on. And my in-laws turned on Ernest Saves Christmas.
You got to love Ernest.
Do you, though?
Well, I do, but I'm biased.
Well, you have a story. You have the famous story. You worked on one of
yes.
Ernest's
I was an extra.
You're the film sociology Ernest correspondent,
yes.
Historian emeritus.
Well, that's a dubious honor at best. I was an extra in Ernest Goes to Jail, mm-hmm. which was shot in Nashville, and that's where I was living at the time. And you can catch all 10 frames of me.
This is a Gruta film.
My 10 frames of fame.
I have the same with Die Hard 2.
Yep.
So, yeah, it's thank goodness for the pause button.
Got to be real quick with mine, though.
Now, have you done that? Have you taken a picture of that and put that on your Facebook profile?
You know, I have not.
I have not either. Maybe that's our 2018 project.
Yeah.
Extra.
Because I actually got the movie not too long ago because Amazon had it for like $3. So.
On Blu-ray.
Yeah.
He's that much clearer.
Yes. Well, he'd almost have to be.
All right, I make fun of Jim Varney because, well,
he's dead.
Wow. And it's
I mean, what's
easy.
He going to do?
I know, but I always I of course snark at the Ernest films, and a lot of us do, especially those in the North. However, the two things I always remember about Jim Varney, besides his bread and butter, Slinky and Toy Story,
mm-hmm.
always very fun in that. And there was a short term comedy show on Comedy Central called Viva Variety.
Yes.
With Thomas Lennon, Michael mm-hmm. Ian Black, you know, and people that have gone, you recognizable things. But one of the guests was Jim Varney, and they did a sketch of the importance of being earnest. And you got to see Jim Varney do Chekhov and do it pretty well. Because
mm-hmm.
I think people forget, when in the earnest films, he also does a lot of disguises, and
oh, yeah.
so he's able to do more than just the shtick.
Oh, he was bigger than just Ernest. I mean,
right?
Ernest paid for him being able to do other things.
Yeah. So anyway, I always enjoyed that. That, and I remember Chekhov from Star Trek got to do a scene from the Cherry Orchard on Viva Variety. That's always fun. Anyway, Mike is here. Yeah, this is where the show's going to possibly go because you haven't seen the last new film you saw was Star Wars.
Star Wars.
And you've seen it twice.
And I've seen it twice, yeah. Well, you got to, because, you know, they're devious that way. They put one version out in 3D and another in IMAX. And I think at least one theater is showing the IMAX 3D. Why the State Museum isn't is beyond me. But it is the best IMAX screen in town still. So that's where I go to for the big time action
so
movies.
You saw the IMAX first?
Yes.
Okay. So you could tell the difference.
Yes.
Okay. Still out there.
Still out there.
All right. I share this with you, Mike, because you will appreciate this. But there was recently, this was January 7th, I believe, but there was a Twitter dispute between two Twitter characters. You'll see. One is at Very Lonely Luke and Emo Kylo Ren. At Kylo R3N. So I'm just going to share this with you. Ladies and gentlemen, yes, reading Twitter accounts, this is your pledge dollars at work here at Film Sociology. Kylo Ren, what's up with the cape? It serves no purpose. If you're cold, stop being pretentious and put on a coat.
There you go.
Response, ugh, I'm taking a page from Darth Vader's classic style. I don't need advice from someone who thinks bathrobes are clothes. Oh, yeah? Did Darth Vader tell you to wear black eyeliner, too, or did you come up with that one on your own? Picture of Mark Hamill from 1977. This is a lot to take from someone who used to dress like a Clockwork Orange extra. Don't be jealous, my dear nephew. We Skywalkers have always been handsome. It's not my fault you got your looks from your dad. Ugh, why do you even mention him? For the record, you got your looks from that time a wampa clawed off part of your face. Listen up, Kylo Ren. I dueled with Darth Vader. I knew Darth Vader. Darth Vader was a friend of mine. Kylo Ren, you are no Darth Vader. How, period, dare, period, you, period. I regret every piggyback ride I ever gave you. There is no way that is a real part of Jedi training anyhow. Sorry I made you give me a piggyback ride, Kylo. My legs were tired from all those years of carrying the fate of the galaxy on my back. You don't even, Very Lonely Luke, do you even force lift? You should talk, Kylo. I taught you to elevate rocks, or I taught you to levitate rocks. You dropped them when a girl walked by. Then you stormed off to write poetry. I write classic love poems like Darth Vader about haunted kisses, beating hearts, scars, etc. You write about power converters. I wrote this haiku for you. Leia and your dad are thinking about divorce, all because of you. Your taunting stinks, and your tantan stinks. That tauntaun was dead, just like your hopes of ever being great like your grandfather. Give yourself a hand. It's weird how having two good hands doesn't stop you from having the limpest handshake in the galaxy. It's weird how you think this conversation is still going. If you want this fight to be over, that's fine with me. Talking to you made me remind why I became a hermit in the first place. It reminded you that no one likes you and you're a failure. When I was your age, Kylo, I put a torpedo in an exhaust port and saved the galaxy. You can't even put your dirty laundry in the hamper. Ew, your sex life isn't relevant to this. Very original. Why don't you build another Death Star? I bet no one will blow it up this time. Why don't you, all caps, build another generation of Jedi? At least when my dad killed the younglings, he owned up to it, unlike someone I know who said his lightsaber slipped 37 times.
Dun, 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 dun.
There you go, ladies and gentlemen.
And scene.
And scene. So that is the Twitter reading portion of the show. Very good. That was fun.
Yeah.
Don't know.
But they did kind of nail it because, let's face it, Kylo Ren is nothing but a teenager.
What are you talking about?
Yes.
A lot of flopping onto his canopy bed. Black canopy bed, of course.
And he can't get the cool girl at school to go out with him. And it's
heavy teen angst.
It is.
Played by 30-something Adam Driver.
Yes.
So he could be in Grease.
Ex-Marine Adam Driver.
That's right. That's right. So anyway, that was fun. Opening in theaters this weekend, because we are now in that period. Well, as a critic, you're as an audience member, because we have the grown-up movies that are still out, yep, and they're still trickling in the town. And then you also have films that, well, they just got to put stuff out there, like The Commuter.
Yeah.
Does the mom have anything? Are you going to take her to that?
Oh, she wants to see just about every movie at the Keystone Arts.
Really? Okay, so yeah. The Commuter's not there.
Yeah, we got to see. What's the Saoirse Ronan picture?
Oh, Lady Bird.
Yeah, that's high on her list.
Very much so. Yeah. Speaking of teen eggs, once you see Lady Bird and Edge of 17, for me, I don't need the entire John Hughes canon after those two films, especially Lady Bird.
Oh, cool.
But yeah, The Commuter, Liam Neeson's biggest, most recent big paycheck. I hope it's leading to something.
Taken on a train. Or
or nonstop on a train, yeah, or something. But, expect. I know Vera Farmiga's in it, which is fun, but we expect a lot of yelling and beating people up and shootings on a train.
Hey, he's still cranking out action movies at 65.
I give him
all the credit in the world.
So long, I just want him to do, like, a James Joyce adaptation or something. Something, well, then, because we were talking earlier, of course, he's been doing a lot of these. When's he going to do something of substance? And I wrote back, he actually did something of substance called Silence. Nobody saw it.
Yeah.
So, and also had Adam Driver. Anyway, The Commuter's opening this week. Paddington 2, which actually we like the first Paddington. We've talked about this on the show. Have you seen it?
No.
It's the fact that it kind of got dumped in theaters in January, like this one. And it was surprisingly very sweet. And the fact that it's a kid's. I enjoyed Paddington as a child. And the fact that there's not they're not playing London Calling or any other pop culture stuff that's needed. It's just the bear and the family and a very vampish Nicole Kidman. And this time Sally Hawkins is back, as well as Peter Capaldi. Hugh Grant is a part of this one.
Yep.
Ben Whishaw, of course, everyone's second favorite Q, is the voice of Paddington. And I think the Socies might be seeing this hopefully next week, but that's also in theaters. But the big film this week, ladies and gentlemen, The Post.
Yes.
I think as they were pushing it at one time, Spielberg, Hanks, Streep.
Yeah, that's all you really need to know.
Right. And it's of course, the story of the Washington Post at the time of the Pentagon Papers. The gentleman who wrote Spotlight also had a hand in the screenplay with this. Yes, that is Mr. Show, the cast of Mr. Show, yep, in the program. And I remember, I think it was Rod Lurie, thought it was distracting casting. It didn't bother me at all. But like I said, the gentleman who wrote this wrote Spotlight, which is, yes, it is the superior journalism film. Hats off to...
For this generation.
It's even better than All the President's Men.
Really?
Yeah, I'm afraid so. You know what? You know who also backs me up? John Krall. So, again, this is not a. This doesn't mean that All the President's Men is crap.
No. It's just, no.
But it seemed like for decades, and we'll get to The Post. All the President's Men was the journalism film. It launched the book and the movie launched a generation of journalism students.
It did.
I'm probably one of them. And it just seemed like an untouchable. It would be like if there was a better hockey film than Slapshot. And if you write me responses.
Is there another hockey movie than Slapshot?
There are, but they're not even close. So Then Spotlight came, and what Spotlight, of course, is a brilliant look at the power of journalism and the tenacity that it takes to get the story. And I remember as John Krull also said, they also got the outfits right. They're reporters. They're not models.
Right.
So anyway, what the Post has going for it is while Spotlight showed the daily grind that would go on for weeks, months, and in some cases years for a story, this one, of course, about the Pentagon Papers, which we find out that the president's going back to the 50s knew about Vietnam, escalated Vietnam, kept sending troops over to Vietnam for decades. And it shows the espionage, the kind of cloak and daggers that journalists need to do sometimes to get a story. There's more than one scene of Bob Olendirk going to an outside payphone to get information. And how do you get the papers? How do they, and there's obviously some parallels between a president not being happy with a paper or papers and what the fate
or media in general.
Or media in general and what the fate of journalism had going against it or for it. The battle of journalism in the early 70s, kind of like today, maybe.
I'm sure it was no accident.
No accident at all.
In fact, I read somewhere this movie got made in like warp speed.
They crank. I think they said it was either 6 months or 9 months from post-production to completion.
Yeah.
Meryl Streep, of course, plays the publisher. And also at the time that this was all going down, that the Washington Post went public on the stock market. So there's already right out of the gate a possible clash with stockholders.
Right.
And of course, stockholders and papers today. Tom Hanks plays Ben Bradley. Solid performances from everybody across the board, of course. We love Tom Hanks, and Tom Hanks is no Jason Robards when it comes to playing Ben Bradley. Now, it's also a different era.
Yeah.
This is, like I said, this is the prequel to All the President's Men. And by the way, the last scene in this film has a nice button to it. Hanks is always solid. What he doesn't have that Robards had was the fear of God feeling around Ben Bradley. If you remember in All the President's Men, where there's a great moment, and I've talked to editors about this, where he's taking the red pen of doom and just slashing the article that Woodward and Bernstein were working on, and Dustin Hoffman tries to speak up, and Robards just gives him a look. And if you've ever been a reporter, you know you don't want that look.
No.
So, and there's a few things that, well, we can't say it here on the air. I've had editors actually quote Ben Bradley in the newsroom. And that's not good. So anyway, but that being said, it is still a very important film. It's really well done, obviously. Spielberg does some handheld work as far as the ins and outs through the newsroom, as well as the ins and outs of Ben Bradley's home when they're reading the papers. The only quibble, and it's a minor quibble, is, of course, near the end of the film, it does go into Spielbergian terms. The John Williams score is subdued, but there is a moment, and those who've seen the film know what I'm talking about, is the phone conversation and then the final scenes with Hanks and Streep, where we are kind of hit over the head with a cardboard tube, not a hammer, about the importance of the film that we just watched.
Yeah.
But there's no looking up looking up in awe over the giant pressing machine. So there's that. No, that being said, go see it. Yeah. It's I didn't make my top 10, but it made the second list, and that's a pretty solid list nonetheless.
I'm going to try to get out in between snow showers this weekend and check it out.
Exactly. So that is playing in theaters this weekend. Also at the Art House, as you mentioned, the new collaboration between Daniel Day-Lewis and Paul Thomas Anderson that is now being much hyped as Daniel Day-Lewis's final film, we'll see, called Phantom Thread, about a renowned dressmaker and his okay, I'm going to read from Keystone, sorry. In 1950s London, a renowned dressmaker finds his carefully tailored life disrupted by his love for a young, strong-willed woman played by Vicky Cripps, sorry. And that is opening this weekend. So let's see. The mom wants to see The Post.
Yep. I want to see The Post.
You want to see The Post.
She wants to see Lady Bird.
Lady Bird is, that was my number two film of the year. I, Tonya. Margot Robbie.
I'm interested to see what they did with it. I can wait till it gets out on video, though.
I will say, there are two films that do a really good Goodfellas imitation. That's Molly's Game. That's Aaron Sorkin's film with Jessica Chastain, and I, Tonya. As far as the storytelling, it does make Tonya Harding the sympathetic character, which. Ponder that.
Well, I thought I was kind of struck with some of that watching the Golden Globes.
Right. And Allison Janney won Best Supporting Actress and well-deserved. Allison Janney's in the Cinema Mom Hall of Fame, I think, playing just a despicable mother to pushing her, you know, stage mother, athletic mother in this case.
I can just picture Nancy Kerrigan watching this movie and just shouting at the screen, why? Why?
See what he did there. So anyway, but no, Robbie's very good, and she still did what she did. It's just she's also surrounded herself with some folks who just haven't evolved. Mm. Also in theaters, yes, Guillermo del Toro's Shape of Water.
Want to see that.
Fun. Yeah. That's the romantic film of the year. And, of course, Darkest Hour with Gary Oldman, who won a Golden Globe for playing Winston Churchill.
Way to go, Gary.
And, of course, my top film of the year, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. Frances McDormand got a Golden Globe, well-deserved as well.
Yeah, we'll probably do our annual Oscar marathon where we go to see all the nominees, you know, sometimes two movies in a day up until the Oscars.
Yeah, two a days there.
Yeah.
Okay, heading down to IU Cinema. And again, this all depends on when you're listening to the show. So if you're listening on Saturday at 3 o'clock, if you're hauling tail down, the 1928 Steamboat Bill Jr., and at 7 o'clock and 9:30 p.m. tonight at IU Cinema, Lady Bird.
Yay.
Also going to be shown at 3 o'clock on Sunday the 14th. At 6:30 p.m. on Sunday the 14th is Yerma. Thursday, January 18th from 1958 at 7 o'clock, Man of the West. Friday the 19th at 6:30 p.m., Avant Noir Experimental Media from the African Diaspora. It's a shorts program. And then the staff selects at 9:30 p.m. from 2012 Spring Breakers. Yeah, Frankie and Nanette go to hell. and James Franco with corn rolls. Saturday the 20th at 3 o'clock, High Sierra. That's a not miss, Humphrey Bogart. And then at 7 p.m., Listen Up Philip from 2014. Looking over at the Historic Art Craft Theater on the 12th. Tonight at 7:30 p.m. on Saturday, Sound of Music. And is that the sing-along version? I'm not sure. Well, you could probably sing along if you wanted to.
Yeah, if you're watching at home, you almost certainly are.
Definitely. And then Friday and Saturday, the 19th and 20th at 2 and 7:30 p.m., Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
Aw.
Yeah.
I always had a soft spot in my heart for that one. I thought the sequels were worthless, but the first one was pretty good. Pretty warm, fuzzy.
I always had a soft spot for Marcia Strassman.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Mrs. Cotter.
Yeah, that too. And then Friday and Saturday, February 9th and 10th, mark your calendars, 2 and 7:30 p.m., Kobe, Bianca, also mark your calendars. Breakfast at Tiffany's on the big screen there. So
Kobe.
Yep. And then also Sunday, January 14th at 5:30 p.m. at the Buskirk Chumley Theater in Bloomington is the Indiana Forest Alliance's Wild and Scenic Film Festival. So you can go to buskirkchumley.org for more information or the Indiana Forest Alliance website. And then January 25th. Through the 27th, I believe. Hope I'm saying that. Yes, through the 27th, the 2018 Bloomington Pride Film Festival. That is happening down there on the 27th.
Was it just breaking away back to back to back to back to back?
Yes. Yeah. So, and then, Sunday, January 28th at 2:30 p.m., they're showing at 2:30 p.m., 5 p.m., a double feature of The Great Silence and Head, the Monkees film.
Yeah.
So if you've...
The Monkees like you've never seen them before.
Exactly, yes. It's not the TV show.
The bad acid trip.
That is the Head. Yes. Yeah, you should check that out. You should really check that out. And then Saturday, February 3rd, Steamboat Bill Jr. screening with a live orchestra. That's always fun. Couple of titles on Blu-ray and DVD. Talking about the Nixon era. Mark Felt, the man who brought down the White House. It's Liam Neeson as Mark Felt. And you have Liam Neeson and Diane Lane, and it's got low energy and doesn't really we get to.
But no one's trying to hijack, you know, the White House.
That is true. Okay, so yeah, I guess yeah, Liam got no money for this one to do this story. When they finally get to the first meeting between Deep Throat and Bob Woodward, I couldn't help it. It felt like a college acting scene, and it's not All the President's Men. So, that's just kind of a minor note. I would stick with the post. New on DVD, two titles of note that I did I did get to watch this week. I finally watched It.
It?
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm going to preface this by I'm not going to do a side-by-side compare-contrast between the television miniseries and this film. However, I do like the fact that for the motion picture, that they're going to make it in the two parts. And this is me that chewed out Harry Potter and The Hunger Games for splitting their book, their last book, in the two films. I understand doing that with It.
Mm-hmm.
Because the first one, and so we have the first half, the young part, basically. It's not set in the 50s now. It's set in the 80s. But it's still the group of kids and their outside, you know, the group of outsiders with their own problems, whether it's bullies or bullies at home. And of course, Pennywise comes in to rain terror amongst the kids. The other part is you can like this Penny. You can like Mr. Sarsgaard's performance as Pennywise and still like Tim Curry.
Yeah.
It's different. Technology is different in 2017 than it was, 1990? So,
sounds about right.
They're able to do some more scary visual stuff in the film version, which I appreciate. I forget about the bullying aspect of this, and I should. I shouldn't, because obviously what Pennywise does for his power is taps into each individual kid's own fear. And the kids in this are really good. I saw this in my living room in the middle of the day, and I was still jumping. So, which makes me wish I could have seen this in a theater with a full house. Kind of like, say, how were your crowds for Star Wars?
The IMAX was packed. When I saw it again at one of the other local theaters in merely 3D, it was kind of sparse.
Was the IMAX crowd receptive?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. You had a lot of lovers in there.
That's cool. I think there are exceptions to the rule. I used to say an audience has no merit for me because I've heard people cheer what I think is a crappy film and vice versa.
Yeah.
But it does it can add to that experience.
Yeah, I mean there was I can only think of a couple of movies that I really wanted to see with a full house of people. You know, Star Wars, the original Star Wars was one of them.
Right.
Another one was Passion of the Christ. Just because I wanted to see the audience reaction to it.
And how was your crowd?
My crowd was a kind of mix of sad and disgusted.
I heard
a lot of several
weeping.
People left.
Really?
Yeah, got up and walked out.
I don't remember people leaving. I heard a lot of weeping.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing it with, there were a lot of bus, well, that film had a lot of bus crowds.
Yeah.
Where, you know, churches organized buses of people. And let's be frank, these were probably people that haven't been to a movie theater in a long, long time because movies are trash. But they filled the theaters with that.
I remember a news story about the producers or the distributors sending tons of free passes to church groups just to get them into the theater for it.
And never forget, ladies and gentlemen, you know what day the Passion of the Christ opened? Cash Wednesday. It did. Anyway, but yeah, there's a lot of scary stuff in this film version of It. I'm excited for part two. It did the job. I mean, this was a film that was not afraid to have kids swear. And I know for some people, Children in Peril is kind of a deal breaker. Well, you can't really avoid that with It.
Mm-hmm.
And also, a little thing. I have to go through the soundtrack. Hold on. hot clicking action here at Film Sociology. But because it's set in the 80s, I sort of get it, but I was impressed with some of the music they used of the era, and that's for instance, Love Removal Machine by The Cult, 666 by Anvil. Always good to see that the Canadian Spinal Tap group Anvil gets some love. But they also use Six Different Ways by The Cure, Antisocial by Anthrax, Dear God by XTC. And yeah, there's a little New Kids on the Block because there's a connection between the chubby kid and the cute girl, and it involves New Kids on the Block. I'm not going to give anything. But not the obvious titles. These are not the wacky, 80, you know, the obvious choices for 80s films. When you, it's like what we mentioned earlier. For some producers, if you need to tell people it's London, you play London Calling. If you need, as Kobe and Bianca have brought up, if you need to let people know it's the Vietnam era, you play CCR.
Yep.
And actually, Green River is used in the post. So, case in point. But these were not the obvious choices. It wasn't Huey Lewis in the News or Michael Jackson or whatever, you know, Culture Club. The kind of obvious 80s choices for music. I appreciate that. So thank you, It. There's that. Another one that's worth checking out is The Foreigner. And it's no, not the play. This is a low-key, dark action film with Jackie Chan and Pierce Brosnan. And I know on paper it sounds like Jackie Chan and James Bond. That's not this.
No.
Chan plays a Chinese-British citizen whose daughter is killed in a bombing in London, and it appears to be IRA-linked. And Brosnan plays against type, but he's been playing against type since he was done with James Bond, basically, one of the Irish politicians who seems to be maybe dragging his feet in Chan's eyes, but he also has a past with the IRA.
Hmm.
Yeah, and go ahead.
Well, the Irish isn't the bad guy. Say it isn't so.
No, not in this. But what's so? And actually, both actors have been playing darker material since, it's probably in at least the last decade. Jackie Chan's got to be, what, in his 60s?
Close to 70,
he's probably. But he still has some moves. And Brosnan's the same way. I think after playing suave James Bond, if you've seen some of his action films since then, they've had darker tones.
Yeah.
And
then there's Mamma Mia, but we won't go there.
You know, I watched the interview section of the disc, and he brings that up, and he's fully aware that people make fun of him about it. I don't anymore, because I had to do two musicals last year, Pierce, and you were an inspiration. So it's this old Chinese guy trying to find out what happened, and he starts doing a cat and mouse game with Brosnan's character because he feels Brosnan's not working fast enough. The Jackie Chan we all know and love kicks in about a third of the way through the film. He can still do a fight scene and do it very well. Can he do a lot of the wacky stuff? No, when he doesn't really, his character doesn't have to do that in this. Yeah. It's directed by Martin Campbell, who worked with Brosnan on GoldenEye and did Mask of Zorro and knows his way around an action film. He did, of course, Casino Royale. But it's a downer of an action film. It does have explosions. It does have fight scenes. It also doesn't pull any punches on as far as people who may or may not have been tied to the IRA and the consequences that come with that. That's vague enough.
Yeah,
but it's worth a rental.
Exactly. Cool.
All right. Shifting gears again, as I mentioned with Mike Perry, and by the way, Mike Perry is my guest. Not really a guest. I think you just come and hang out,
yeah,
which I appreciate. Now that award season is over for me, I've been trying to catch up on some films that have been sent to me, First World Problems, and then share them with you. So here's a little mixture of The Film Show with That Thing I Do on Saturday Nights. The famed documentary filmmaker Robert Muggy, this film is finally out on DVD, or at least I got a copy of it, Rhythm and Bayous, A Roadmap to Louisiana Music. And it's a fun couple of hours looking at the history of the rich music history of the state of Louisiana. Everything from country and gospel and rockabilly to blues, jazz, Dixieland, etc. Alan Lomax would have loved this film. And there's really cool performances from everybody from Henry Gray to Rosie Ledette, Nathan Williams. I'm a big Zydeco fan. Henry Butler, even the Reverend Gerald Lewis and Little Brian. So anyway, this is out on MVD Visual. Rhythm and Bayou's A Roadmap to Louisiana Music. That's a lot of fun. Also, by Film Movement, or as I like to call it, the Movie of the Month Club, this was a film that got, it was an official selection and got the jury prize at Cannes, I think, 2 years ago. It is a domestic drama from Japan called Harmonium, and it's set in a family business. The gentleman, the dad of the house, does metal sheet pressing for certain businesses. With a new child and a wife, and he brings in an apprentice that he knew from a long, long time ago, and the apprentice just got out of prison. So as time goes on throughout this 2-hour film, it starts to unravel like an onion. not that onion. not that Velcro onion. But that's okay. So we find out the past between the two characters and what may or may not have happened that led to this guy getting in prison, and then how actions amongst the family and this guy really start to unravel. And it's not a family film. It is a family film. It's a messed up family film. But it's very tense, low key, but very tense. I hope nobody in the States remakes this, but it's really, really solid.
So, 'cause we don't need another Old Boy.
Oh, well, it's not as violent as Old Boy. Or are you talking about just remakes of
yes.
Asian films? Yeah, no, it's more of a mental hammer. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
Also out on Film Movement, and this was, I think it was last year's Best Actress winner at Cannes, Emmanuelle Bercot and Vincent Cassel in a film called My King. And this feels like a... it's interesting that somebody referred to it as one of the sexiest films of the decade. I see some people actually also being repelled by this couple. Not quite Butterfield to say Last Tango in Paris, but it is a relation. It is this. It is the history of a marriage and a coupling between a restaurateur and a lady, and they kind of feed off each other's chaos.
Ah.
So they love each other. They hate each other. It has a French Cassavetes feel to it, or those intense couple movies that anybody in Europe or in the United States made in the late 60s and early 70s.
Okay.
So not a first date film, but really solid, really good performances from both actors. And Vincent Cassel, you've recognized from a number of things. Now, I had two really good, fairly recent movies, and then I just get random stuff that just came out on video. For instance, I a couple weeks ago, actually on last week's show, I talked about the 1959 filmed Go Johnny Go. This was one of those films, Mike. It was Alan Freed and Chuck
okay.
Berry, you know, where it's like 70 minutes and 40 minutes of it is musical performances with a really thin story kind of sewn in there.
Yeah.
And then I also got the 1980s miniseries of George C. Scott as Mussolini. Not kidding. This was the thing.
Oh, man.
With Lee Grant, Robert Downey Jr., Gabriel Byrne, Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio, and Virginia Madsen.
That's a nice cast.
That's a nice cast in a 1985 miniseries trying to humanize El Duce, but also showing what El Duce's day job was.
Yeah.
This week's odd choice, I'm gonna play the trailer for you first, and then we'll discuss it.
This woman is having a love affair with the supernatural.
I'm here, Nikki.
Baby, how I want you.
Something is disturbed him. Something powerful. Very powerful.
Ruby. Piper Laurie was frightening in Carrie. She is terrifying as Ruby.
Nikki!
christened in blood, raised in sin. She's sweet 16. Let the party begin.
It's here. It's very strong.
First, there was The Exorcist, then The Omen and Carrie. But nothing you have ever seen before could prepare you for what you are going to see in Ruby. Starring Piper Laurie.
It was never Jake. It was always you. You believe me now, don't you, Nikki? You have to believe me now. I did it for you, Nikki. Look what I did.
Stuart Whitman. Roger Davis.
The presence is real, with motives of his own. Leslie is a natural medium. What I'm afraid of now is that the presence may be powerful enough to act without the benefit of Leslie's mind.
And introducing Janet Baldwin as Ruby's daughter. Ruby will take you further into the world of the supernatural than any film has ever dared.
Okay, that was Ruby from 1977.
You really need to look up the trailer on
yeah,
YouTube.
You really should. And Mike and I were talking off. This was because you've never seen it.
No.
But I remember. We remember the trailer.
Yes.
That's the power of trailers in the 1970s. By the way, Piper Laurie's not scary in this one compared to she was in Carrie. But you had to say that back then.
Oh yeah, because Carrie really changed the trajectory of her career.
Right.
I mean, she got known for crazy old lady roles later on.
But yeah, but that was her, and Carrie was Piper Laurie's return to film after about a decade off. Yeah. And so, but anyway, but because of the success of Carrie, Piper Laurie got her own film. I'll briefly go through the plot. So it's set in the 30s down south somewhere. And Piper Laurie, Ruby, is a singer who also has a mafioso boyfriend. And as they're going out for a moonlight boat ride, some of the guys show up, some of the guys in the gang show up and gun him down. And he doesn't know if his love set him up for this or not, and she's pregnant. That's basically the first couple minutes of the film. Then we jump to 1951, same area. There's a drive-in that Ruby runs. Everybody who's a part of the hit works for Ruby. Ruby lives in a house near the drive-in, and there's an old – she's not singing anymore, and the old nightclub where she used to be a star is still untouched in the back. Little Mrs. Havisham, a little bit. And then – strange, spooky things happen at the drive-in. Is the ghost of her lover back? Is he back for revenge? The daughter, who is now deaf and mute, possesses her later in the film. That's not really giving away a whole lot. But there's, you heard the other titles that were dropped in the trailer, and they're kind of picking up on some of that stuff. In fact, there's even the daughter does a spider walk, which was not in the original theatrical run of The Exorcist. But word had gotten out about that scene. I mentioned on social media earlier this week what I love about the film Blackula and Scream, Blackula, Scream is the performance of William Marshall, because William Marshall was a classically trained stage actor and what is on paper a silly idea. It's a black vampire movie. You know, an African prince is bitten by Count Dracula and then the title and so on. And then he runs havoc through modern 1972 Los Angeles. William Marshall treated the material like it was a Shakespearean tragedy. That's the appeal of it for me. Piper Laurie in Ruby treats what is on paper a pretty silly drive-in horror movie, but she's treating it like she's in a Tennessee Williams play. And at times, it's like the Dogberry story in Much Ado. It almost feels like she's in a completely different picture. But she's really good. a lot of her, you know, with a drink and pining about the past and trying to wonder if it's her lover. And, Yeah, I mean, it's really, and you know, very low budget. There's a lot of jump cuts of one of the things that's used as a weapon, and you should always be careful with this, folks, especially in the drive-in. The old speakers with the ropes on them, yeah, because they attack Stuart Whitman among other things. it's intriguing. It's silly, but she's really good.
I may have to check that out.
You should.
But I do agree. Getting back to William Marshall. I mean, he brought that same dedication to Pee-wee's Playhouse.
The King of Cartoons.
And to Star Trek.
Yep. He was great in Star Trek as the mad scientist.
Yeah. I mean, you could tell. I mean, he just brought weight with him wherever he went.
And Laurie does the same. And I was watching the Blu-ray. Yes, I have this on Blu-ray, so it's clearer. But the ending is weird, and we find out that the producers tacked on the ending against the director's wishes. That is brought up in the commentary track, as well as a couple of interviews from the late 80s. I mean, there's a lot going on with this disc, and I can spend a weekend watching this, and I probably will. But yeah, this is one I always remembered the trailer, never got around to it, and now I have. So thank you, MVD Visual, for all this Ruby talk. But that'd be a fascinating if we watching Carrie and Ruby side by side. And of course, the other for you other trivia nerds out there, I believe Piper Laurie and Sissy Spacek were, of course, I think about 9 years apart, playing mother and daughter, and then finally in the early 90s they played sisters in a film version of The Glass Harp. So that's out there. I'm very excited about that. Okay, we're going to get to Dead People We Like because we don't have time for Dead People We Don't Like. And this is also kind of also Mike Perry's other job here at Film Sociology, besides being the Jim Varney consultant.
It's on my business cards.
Right, sure it is. When TV stars die, I always like to, yes or no, and we have two, and actually very closely linked. But I'm always intrigued to see what films they worked on before they became stars or when they were taking a break from their series. And I guess we'll start with Rosemarie.
Oh.
I know. I, as we were joking earlier, I think if you're on the Dick Van... So Carl Reiner and Dick Van Dyke, and there's a case of scotch somewhere for somebody who who is the last survivor of that. So, but you recently saw a Baby Rosemarie footage.
Well, I listened to Baby Rosemarie footage because when she was younger, back in the 30s and the 40s. Yeah, she's been performing all of her life.
Yeah, I think she even said she had the longest running career in show business.
Yeah, I mean,
90 years.
Yeah, she started singing on stage when she was like 3 or 4. But I did catch on Radio Classics on Sirius XM, that's your shameless plug. they had an episode of the Jimmy Durante show, which was a variety show.
Yep.
So you had some singing, some comedy, and some dancing. And Baby Rosemarie was a guest on that show.
Wow.
And, of course, modern audiences, you know, you got the Dick Van Dyke show.
Exactly.
And I'm a game show geek, so you know, she was on Hollywood Squares its entire run.
Yeah, and after the Dick Van Dyke show, she did constant television.
Yeah.
I mean, one-offs everywhere.
She was on the Doris Day show.
Right.
I think the last comedy I remember seeing her in was in an episode of Caroline in the City, where she and Maury Amsterdam were playing comic strip writer partners.
Nice. And I also remember her as Frank's mom on Murphy Brown.
Yeah.
But yeah, going back, so I was like, okay, so her first credit... And it was Baby Rosemarie in 1933, Ramblin' Round Radio Row number 3, Top Banana from 1954. I'm not doing all the titles, folks. The Big Beat from 1958. Don't Worry, We'll Think of a Title from 1966. That's with Maury and Rose. I was trying to remember. Oh, yeah. Water. Dead Heat on a Merry-Go-Round from 1966. A lot of TV, Memory of Us from 1974. Going through Lunch Wagon from 1980, Cheaper to Keeper. Wow. Mac Davis, Tova Fulcha, and Rosemarie from 1980. Witchboard, 1988. Salesman, 1993. Really? Oh, I didn't know this. Uncredited in 1998, played the voice of Mrs. Bates in Gus Van Sant's Psycho.
Oh.
Now I got to look
that
up.
Is that the Vince Vaughn
Psycho? Yeah, the Vince Vaughn shot for shot, except for the one thing.
Yeah.
Well, I would look at that and see that. That's true. Yeah, I played Clara in Lost and Found with David Spade. So anyway, that's cool. So yeah. Salute to Rose. And then, of course, Jerry Van Dyke.
If you grew up watching television in the 60s, you know, one title comes to mind.
My Mother, the Car.
My Mother, the Car. The most reviled, yet, you know, people who remember this show remember it fondly for how bad it was.
It's ridiculous. I mean, it truly is. Makes Mr. Ed look like, the West Wing.
Yeah, I mean, the basic premise is man's mother dies and is reincarnated as, I can't remember the model of the car, but a vintage car who speaks to him.
Yeah, but let's never forget, that thing lasted 30 episodes.
Yeah.
And you have shows like, I always remember, I don't know why I always remember, but like the Michael Malley show lasted one episode. I mean, if they would, you know, of course, in today's world, it would air once and then it would get pulled.
Right.
But in 1965, you kind of gave it a shot, see what's there.
It was very rare for TV
to pull something that
quick. I can think of two examples. Turn On with, it was a laugh-in ripoff. ABC ran it for one episode. It was hosted by Tim Conway.
Right, I vaguely remember that.
And it was one and done. And then Jackie Gleason starred in a game show called You're in the Picture.
Yep, I remember. I heard about that as well.
That the following week, after the first show bombed so bad, he came back the second week to apologize for it. And that time slot turned into what would become the Jackie Gleason show.
That we all know and love. Okay, before that, of course, he played Stacy Petry. The Dick Van Dyke Show, played Norman Jones in the 1963 film version of The Courtship of Betty's Father with Glenn Ford, was in Palm Springs Weekend,
saw that a couple of weeks ago,
and played Matt Douglas Jr. in McClintock, Wayne's Taming the Shrew.
He sings with Stephanie Powers in that one.
Way to go, big fella. Loving Kisses from 1965. Angel in My Pocket from 1969. Also did quite a bit of television. And what I love about that, the Jerry Van Dyke story, is, of course, if you look up any article or book on the worst TV ever made, he's always there. And then he got a second chance. He got a second boost with Coach.
Yep.
And funny as hell is Luther. So I always remember my first newspaper job was in Fountain County, Indiana. I was living in Covington. Danville in Illinois was a thriving metropolis by comparison. And I was living there when they had Jerry Van Dyke Day.
Oh, yeah.
And they had a parade for him because he came down. And I think in my collection I have from the Danville newspaper a full photo of Jerry Van Dyke, a publicity photo from Coach.
Nice.
And they use it. Let's call it what it is. It's a newspaper centerfold of Jerry Van Dyke. So, yeah, salute to you, Jerry. Thank you much. All right, we got a few minutes left. We've covered a lot of ground here. You mentioned earlier that the Marm is wanting to see a lot of stuff at Keystone.
Yeah.
Do you remember the first film you took the Marm to? By the way, we call her the Marm because she's a teacher and she was Kobe's teacher.
Yes.
So there's a little film sociology history here for you.
Now she's retired. But I believe I took her to see Toy Story 3 was our first movie
date. That was your first?
Yeah.
Holy cow.
Yep, I think that was our first movie date.
Your pick or hers, do you remember?
I don't.
Well, you picked it together.
Yeah. It was a nice middle ground movie. I mean, it was...
Wow.
and finished it up with dinner at Yat's.
Oh, that's a good... That's a good evening right there.
Yep. She and I go to movies quite often. Haven't been quite so much lately, but with all the holiday stuff going on, but we hope to catch up our... Oscar movies.
Well, that's you're that audience. You're the okay, it's up for consideration. Let's go check it out. The curiosity audience. So we like that. Man, Toy Story 3. couple things about that I always remember. Well, of course, is the scene near the incinerator where there is that moment of, are you really gonna, you can't go down, really? It almost feels like you're watching United 93. You're like, come on. And then there's that. And yes, everybody, you have a big lump in your, I always say, I had a big lump in my throat at the very, very end. It's still not as big a lump during the Jesse montage of Toy Story 2. But that's not, yeah, that hurts.
But
More sad Sarah McLachlan music.
I always thought that the way they wrapped up Toy Story 3 was perfect, to the point where I don't want to see Toy Story 4.
I feel bad. I know. I don't want it either. And I know Tim.
It's going to the well just one time too many.
Tim and Tom are going to get a ridiculous amount of money for it, and everybody else.
I wanted to see Incredibles 2 before there was a Toy Story 4 or a Cars 3.
Well, that's coming. Well, that happened. It is coming. So yes. But yeah, and it was, the other fun thing was I recently showed Emma White Lightning. Yes, I showed my daughter Burt Reynolds car movies because of Archer. But of course, that was her first, her first visual of Ned Beatty. No, I have not shown Emma Deliverance. Get off my back. I don't know. But he's the voice of Lotso, of course, in Toy Story 3, and he's great in that.
Shifting gears.
Yes, sir.
I want to ask you a question.
Oh, here we go. This is what happens when there's 4 minutes left in the show.
I think you'll be able to cover this in three.
All right.
Give me your response to Tommy Wiseau at the Golden Globes.
Okay. And by the way, I liked The Disaster Artist. I didn't love it as much as I do The Room. No way they're going to let him speak. No way. I mean, Franco, by the way, performance artist, James Franco.
Yeah.
Golden Globe winner James Franco, apparently accused James Franco. I think as soon as he called Wiseau up, didn't the orchestra like chime in immediately? No, they were not going to let Tommy Wiseau speak in front of a global audience. No, and I read, I think the AV Club or somebody had reported or purported that he was basically going to go up there and plug The Room. and I know, like, this past Wednesday, they did a screening of it at certain theaters across the country. I think he would have kept talking even after they went to break. It would have been the first time you would have seen people, like, escort a person off the stage.
I thought that was the funniest moment of the entire show.
That he tried to bring him up.
Yep. Well, he did. He did bring him up, but then... not so fast, fella, but when he stepped up to the microphone.
Yeah, I think he would have, it would have been performance art. Well, he is a walking performance artist. Oh, by the way, you should create film sociology guest, Tommy Wiseau. And no, I'm not playing the interview this week because it won a Golden Globe, contrary to what people think about my relationship with the film The Room. So. I think it's more people are going to go see the film The Room now that it's gotten the award. I don't know if Wiseau's going to do anything new. He could just basically go to film festivals and college campuses and I noticed because Kobe and I got to meet him at a screening at IU and we found out from the student union director how much he got for an appearance. Him and Greg Sestra, they're doing okay. they're doing okay. They're doing better than us. I wish we could get X amount of dollars to go to a screening and be coherent, sort of. So,
my take on The Disaster Artist is I just hope it doesn't encourage Tommy to make The Room 2.
No, he's not going to make The Room 2. No, he'll come up with... there was a sitcom he's been trying to develop, an office-type sitcom. So we'll see if that happens, but I did see that, and it was funny because we were watching Get Out during the Emmy or during the Golden Globes, and I did get a text from Kobe saying that James Franco won. I'll see if Wiseau tries to crash a stage later, and turned out it sort of happened. So, all right, Mike Perry, Mike Perry, you ready? Here's some words to live by: Soylent Green is people, Zardoz is spoken. Thanks for hanging out. It's always good to have you here. Go see some award contenders, will
I'm
you?
Going to.
All right.
I'm going to.
Ladies and gentlemen, go see a good movie. You deserve it. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!